Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Efforts to reform global pandemic preparedness and response are happening too slowly, the World Health Organization's Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response said on Monday. In a new report, former premiers of New Zealand and Liberia, Helen Clark and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, warned that COVID-19 has continued to cause illness, deaths and economic losses, thanks to uneven progress in tackling infections. Among their recommendations, the panel called for heads of state and government to make faster progress, especially at the UN General Assembly. A new leader-led Global Health Threats Council should also be launched to provide much-needed leadership and accountability, the independent panel said. Much of the groundwork for reforms has been done, it noted, adding that it was imperative to end this pandemic and prepare for the next global health threat. UN-appointed independent human rights experts have urged China to release on humanitarian grounds imprisoned citizen journalist and human rights defender Zhang Zhan. Her health is deteriorating rapidly and she can no longer walk unaided, the experts said on Monday. Failure by the Chinese authorities to act swiftly and effectively could have fatal consequences for Zhang Zhan, they warned in a joint statement before calling for her immediate and unconditional release along with medical treatment. The rights experts, who are appointed by the Human Rights Council, said that Ms. Zhan had been detained in Shanghai since May 2020. She is serving a four-year sentence and was originally arrested after posting a video online that criticized the government's handling of the COVID-19 outbreak. The arrest and detention of Zhang Zhan and a number of other citizen journalists reporting on the outbreak of COVID-19 in Wuhan, a matter of vital public interest, is deeply troubling, the experts said, Noting that they are in contact with the authorities on the matter. Over the past decade, the Hungarian government's stranglehold of the media poses a threat to human rights during the upcoming elections, warned a UN-appointed independent rights expert. Following an official visit to the country, UN Special Rapporteur Irene Khan warned that authorities have reshaped the sector by funding pro-government media that ostracizes critical voices. Ms. Khan called for the safeguarding of editorial freedom and access to diverse sources of information, while also expressing serious concerns that reports of hate speech, harassment or stigmatization of journalists and human rights defenders who work with migrants, refugees and the LGBTI community. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury in Brunswick, Georgia, is set to determine the fate of three white men charged with hunting down and murdering 25-year-old black jogger Ahmaud Arbery. Lawyers for the defense made closing arguments Monday. A nearly all-white panel of 12 jurors and three alternates is set to hear a rebuttal from prosecutors today before beginning deliberations. Defense attorney Laura Hoag, who represents Greg Michael, the former police officer, blamed Arbery's own actions for his death, and she drew outrage over these comments.
Turning Ahmaud Arbery into a victim after the choices that he made does not reflect the reality of what brought Ahmaud Arbery to Satilla Shores in his khaki shorts with no socks to cover his long, dirty toenails.
Hoag's comment drew audible gasps from the courtroom. Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, was so upset she got up and briefly left the trial. She later condemned Hoag's remarks.
She described Ahmaud as his long legs and his dirty, long toenails. That was just a beyond rude. Regardless of what kind of toenails he had, what size legs he had, that was still my son. And my son actually was running for his life.
Taken together, Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and William Bryan face 9 counts that could see each of them sentenced to life in prison. In Yemen, the Saudi-led military coalition has launched air raids on the capital, Sana'a, with reports of massive explosions in Sana'a's northern neighborhoods. Saudi officials said they targeted Houthi military sites in retaliation for the rebel group's drone attack Saturday on sites in Saudi Arabia, including a major oil hub in Jeddah. The latest violence comes after thousands of people marched through the streets of Sana'a on Monday, protesting U.S. support for the Saudi-led military coalition.
We, the Yemeni people, took to the streets today to denounce the military escalation carried out by America, the economic blockade, and the continuation of aggression. We had thought that when Joe Biden took office, he would keep his promises on stopping the war in Yemen and open the airport in Sana'a. It turned out that all that talk was a lie.
In Washington, D.C., a bipartisan group of senators has introduced a bill that would block the Biden administration's planned sale of $650 million worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Republicans Rand Paul and Mike Lee joined independent Senator Bernie Sanders as co-sponsors in a statement. Senator Paul said, quote, "By participating in this sale, we would not only be rewarding reprehensible behavior, but also exacerbating a humanitarian crisis in Yemen," unquote. The United Nations warns the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen and naval blockade has led to the worst humanitarian disaster in half a century, with millions displaced and a step away from starvation. U.S. coronavirus infections and hospitalizations are continuing to rise, even as COVID-19 continues to claim more than 1,000 lives per day. Cases among children are up 32% from 2 weeks ago, representing about a quarter of all U.S. infections. On Monday, top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci called on everyone 5 and older to get vaccinated, warning the Thanksgiving holiday could trigger a dangerous winter surge unless people take measures now to slow the spread of coronavirus. Meanwhile, the White House said Monday 95% of federal workers have met a vaccine mandate covering 3.5 million U.S. government employees. And the CDC added Germany and Denmark to a list of high-risk destinations amidst a massive surge of COVID cases across most of Europe. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli soldiers shot dead a Palestinian man after he killed an Israeli settler and wounded 3 others Sunday. The confrontation took place in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the site of recent attacks from Israeli police. In a statement, Hamas said the Palestinian man was politically affiliated with the armed resistance movement in the Gaza Strip. Israeli forces immediately raided the refugee camp where he lived in retaliation and arrested several of his family members, including his daughter. In El Salvador, President Nayib Bukele has announced plans to build the world's first Bitcoin city in the eastern coastal region of La Union. Bukele said the city would be financed by cryptocurrency bonds and would harness geothermal power from a volcano. Many opponents say a Bitcoin city would likely lead to further displacement and other catastrophic impacts on local communities. This is Salvador's president speaking Sunday.
It's going to be right there in the Fonseca Gulf, and it's going to include everything, residential areas, commercial areas, services, museums, entertainment, bars, restaurants, airport, port, rail, everything devoted to Bitcoin.
Bukele's announcement comes despite massive opposition to Bitcoin in El Salvador, which is also the first country in the world to declare the cryptocurrency as legal tender. Meanwhile, several civil society groups critical of Bukele's government were raided by the Salvadoran National Police Monday. The widespread raids targeted feminist, humanitarian aid, and other social justice groups. In Wisconsin, police say the man charged with plowing his SUV into a parade of Christmas revelers was involved in a domestic disturbance just minutes before Sunday's attack, which killed 5 people and injured 48 others. Waukesha Police Chief Daniel Thompson on Monday identified the driver as 39-year-old Daryl Brooks of Milwaukee.
The subject was taken into custody a short distance from the scene, and we are confident he acted alone. There is no evidence that this is a terrorist incident.
Brooks has a criminal record that includes arrest for sexual abuse, battery, and domestic abuse. He was arrested earlier this month, accused of running over the mother of his child with a vehicle in a gas station parking lot on November 2nd and released on a $1,000 cash bond just 5 days before Sunday's deadly assault. The House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection has subpoenaed five more allies of former President Trump, including longtime Republican operative Roger Stone. At least six people who were part of the mob that entered the Capitol reportedly worked as security for Stone and were linked to the far-right Oath Keepers militia group. Also subpoenaed was Alex Jones, the far-right conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host. This month, Jones was found liable for damages in lawsuits brought by families of the 20 children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. For years, Jones spread false reports that the shooting was a government hoax and the victims' families were paid actors, resulting in online harassment and death threats for Sandy Hook families. For the first time ever, the U.S. has been added to a list of backsliding democracies. This year's annual report from the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance cites voter suppression in many U.S. states, runaway political polarization, and former President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Meanwhile, a United Nations human rights expert has denounced Republican voter suppression efforts, saying partisan gerrymandering and new restrictions on voting are undermining democracy by denying communities of color an equal right to vote. This is Fernand de Varenne, the UN Special Rapporteur on Minority Issues, speaking Monday.
It is almost a tyranny of the majority, where minorities' right to vote is being denied in many areas, in many parts of the country, and that this cannot be a positive development. This cannot be consistent with the fundamental values of democracy, and certainly it does not seem to be consistent with the United States' international human rights obligations.
President Joe Biden Monday renominated Jerome Powell to serve as chair of the Federal Reserve. Powell was first appointed to the post by former President Trump in 2018.
When our country was hemorrhaging jobs last year and there was panic in our financial markets, Jay's steady and decisive leadership helped to stabilize markets and put our economy on track to a robust recovery.
During his tenure, Powell has refused to acknowledge the climate crisis and has a record of weakening Wall Street regulations. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has vowed not to confirm Powell, calling him a, quote, dangerous man to head up the Fed. New York State's Assembly has found overwhelming evidence that former Governor Andrew Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment while in office. The investigation, which took 8 months to complete, largely corroborated a damning report by New York Attorney General Letitia James, finding Cuomo sexually harassed at least 11 women. Cuomo resigned in August, even as he continued to deny the allegations. And the state of Florida has officially exonerated four African-American men falsely accused of raping a white woman near Groveland, Florida, in 1949. Two of the so-called Groveland Four were brutally murdered as a result of the false accusations. The case is now seen as a racially charged miscarriage of justice emblematic of the Jim Crow South. Carol Greenlee is the daughter of Charles Greenlee, who was sentenced to life in prison over the false accusations. She spoke to Democracy Now! In January of 2019, just after Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis granted posthumous pardons.
My nieces, my nephews, my brothers, my son all carried this cloud over them. It's It has lifted that cloud from being carried by innocent children, innocent family members, and I feel that a chain has been broken. It felt like the door of justice swung open and the nightmare ended of torture, waking up in night to the pain of what had happened to my father.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Well, it's Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! For local listeners here in the Northeast, Kansas, and Northwest, Missouri, generally the Kansas City area. You can get Democracy Now! Live on the television at 7 in the morning, every morning, every weekday morning, on channel over-the-air 19.2. That's the local PBS affiliate at, I think it's KANU, I think. It's 19.2. And at 8 a.m., an hour later, you can catch it on your radio in FM at KKFI, the local community radio station out of Kansas City. On your dial, it's located at 90.1 FM. So at 7 in the morning on the local PBS affiliate, 19.2 over-the-air antenna, and at 8 o'clock, FM radio 90.1 KKFI. Now we'll take a short music break, and then we'll go right into Counter Spin. In the second hour, we have, or this can be happening Tuesday, we have our co-host John Grant. We'll be checking out the latest headlines from New York Times and plus any other current events we want to talk about. In the meantime, I hope you're having a great day. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. The 1920s. It's a came off the Internet Archive in the public domain. We've got time for some more music, and once again, we'll be taking callers in the second hour when we go live with John Grant of the This Can't Be Happening News Writers Collective. We'll have John Grant on second hour, taking calls, discussing the latest headlines in the New York Times and whatever covers our mind at the time. Here's some more music. ¶¶
and the man in the moon. When the little birds are nesting and I listen to them croon, there's two lonely people in the whole wide world, that's me and the man in the moon. Just before I'm calling sheep, through my window he comes to peep, and with each other we're sympathizing. Looking at the happy sweethearts while they sit around and spoon, there's two lonesome people in the whole wide world, that's me and the man in the moon.
Ambassadors, Man in the Moon, again from the 1920s, the Roaring 20s of the previous century, and the Roaring 20s again, if you ask me. Now we're going to go into Counterspin, which is put out by Fairness and Accuracy Investigative Reporting. That's FAIR.org. Every Tuesday, in the hour, the news hour, before John Grant comes up on the second hour. I noticed we got some callers. I am not accepting calls until the next hour, the top of the next hour. In the meantime, here is Counterspin, the latest from fair.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, if you read a newspaper, you know that inflation is a dire and very important thing happening right now, a problem for the Biden administration and for economic policymakers and for regular people who want to buy milk. You don't really need to understand inflation, elite media seem to say, but you do need to be mad about it and direct blame for it toward yourself. John Schwartz writes about elite media's confusing and conflicting instructions around inflation, among other things, at The Intercept. We'll talk with him about the current economic reality and the storyline. Also on the show, ethically deficient radio host Alex Jones's defamation case is a political story about the impact of energetic, intentional disinformation. It's a media story about how profitability around hateful BS seems to change the terms about whether things that call themselves news outlets should be held accountable for demonstrably harmful lies. It's also a speech rights story about whether you can yell fire in a crowded theater and then say, ha ha, any dummy would know I was just kidding. We'll ask, how does the legal system solve a problem like Alex Jones, with Enrique Armijo, professor of law at Elon University. That's coming up. We'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. A New York Times headline read, "Inflation warning signs flash red, posing challenge for Washington." A subsequent Times piece underscored the problem and the solution. The White House says its plans will slow inflation. The big question is, when? That framing is echoed and adumbrated everywhere in corporate media. Inflation is coming for your cup of coffee next, says CNN. Inflation's wrath hits home, was USA Today's rubric. And then, surprise, surprise, CNBC has inflation has 88% of Americans worried. True, there's an admixture of, for example, the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman's history says don't panic about inflation, but anyone can see that judging by sheer focus and attention, serious, smart people organize their thinking around inflation more than many another economic indicator. In the recent words of our guest, whenever the corporate media moves en masse like this, it's a good idea to slow down and consider what's actually happening and why. John Schwartz writes for TheIntercept.com. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, John Schwartz.
Well, I'm so happy to be here, especially to talk about this in particular, because this is one issue where you realize that there is no one room where all the people get together and decide what it's going to be in the U.S. media. But it really does seem like there is.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We hear media complain about how we used to all talk around the water cooler and agree on everything, and we know that's not true, and yet you have to acknowledge the power of media in making it seem as though we're all in one conversation. So the phenomenon really here is corporate media alarm and the worldview that that reflects. But let me ask you first about what there is there. What reality is it that these headlines are referring to?
The reality is that inflation went up from last October to this past October by 6.2%, I believe it was, according to one measure that includes food and fuel. And so that tends to go to extremes more than the standard measure, which excludes them. But just to be fair, because food and fuel are important for people, a number to think about is legitimately 6.2%. So that's over a year. And it happened that inflation went up from September to October by 0.9%, meaning that if something cost $10 in September, it now costs $10.09.
So is that the bare understanding? Because if I'm reading headlines, I'm reading about costs of things that I want to buy going up in a way that's going to really affect my life. And it seems as though the increase in inflation is most meaningful in terms of how much it's going to affect the price of my coffee or how much it's going to affect something else that I as an individual are buying. But there's other things that inflation means that are really maybe more at work behind the alarm here.
That's right. It's funny, the Washington Post had not one but two above-the-fold stories about inflation this week on one particular day, one talking about how terrible inflation was and one about how it was destroying Biden's agenda. And they also had a chart covering, I don't know, the last 10 or 15 years that by itself explained that their story was not what they were telling you. It was a chart showing real wages going down a little bit over the last year when inflation is taken into account, meaning that, you know, inflation was 6.2% over the last year. Wages for regular people went up by 5.8%, so the purchasing power went down a bit. But the chart itself showed that people's purchasing power being eroded, going down in real terms when inflation was taken into account, had happened a lot over the past 10 years. And it wasn't a gigantic front page emergency story then. Like, what was the difference? And the difference was this, was that there were not high rates of inflation making that happen in the past during the Obama administration, I think even during a little bit of the Trump administration. The difference is that now it is happening with higher rates of inflation, and higher rates of inflation affect people with tons of money in a way that is never described in the corporate media. To my knowledge, I literally have never seen this. And the story there is that household debt in the United States is about $14.5 trillion. So that's a very big number. It's about 75% of the size of the entire U.S. economy. And when there is inflation, most of that debt is fixed-rate debt like mortgages, student loans, things like that. And the inflation erodes the value of that debt because it's set in nominal terms. Like it stays at $15.5 trillion no matter what level of inflation there is.
Right.
And so 6.2% inflation, that works out to a transfer of wealth from creditors to debtors of about $850 billion, so almost $1 trillion. That is a lot of money. It doesn't work out precisely as different people have different levels of debt. It's not totally transfer of $850 billion from the rich to the poor, but it is a significant amount. And you may have noticed people with a lot of money do not like to lose it. And that's really at the root of this inflation freakout. It's that plus the fact that there's a very tight labor market right now, meaning that there's low unemployment and workers have much more power than they generally do. And the standard treatment for an economy with high levels of inflation is to increase interest rates, load the economy, which throws people out of work. And that is the goal, you know, that they do not like a booming economy. They do not like low levels of inflation. Creditors in general do not. And what they would like to see is a slower economy with lower rates of inflation and higher rates of unemployment. So it's these two things, their goal to slow the economy, raise unemployment, and the eroding value of the debt that they hold.
Well, you're talking about differential impacts, both of inflation and of proposed responses to inflation, and differentiating that impact is exactly what elite media don't generally do. They talk about us and them in a way that is meant to, you know, collapse other folks into the us that, you know, really don't belong there. And so the New York Times' Neil Irwin has an explainer. That's a kind of piece where it's like, you don't need to know the details, just here's the nuts and bolts of this issue that you're hearing about. And it's called Who's to Blame for Rising Prices? And this is all already collapsing inflation to rising prices in ways that are unnuanced, as you've just discussed. But still, in this like kind of let's make it simple, let's break it down, who's to blame for rising prices? One of the New York Times acceptable answers is all of us.
Exactly.
Right? You know, and the reason is we, I'm quoting, we shifted our spending towards stuff rather than services. That's one of the reasons. And then also, and many of us elected to stop working or work less. This is the New York Times, the paper of record, trying to talk to people, you know, and say prices are going up, here's why. And their reason is you messed up. You know, you messed up during the pandemic. You started buying the wrong things and you made wrong choices about employment. I mean, we talk about this as an economic issue, but it's obviously a media, a corporate media issue as well.
Yeah, it's a class issue. It's one of the issues where the class bias of the media really shows up in its most powerful form. It's absolutely unmistakable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I wanted you to say in response to that New York Times article, except, you know, that these kind of headlines and stories, they're not just lamentations, they're also calls for action.
The call for action is to get back to work.
Exactly. And in terms of actions that are responses from various entities about dealing with this abstract sounding inflation, well, some of those responses are going to also affect people in their day-to-day lives. So it's meaningful to kind of unpack what media think or are telling us is the right thing to do here.
Yeah, there is, you know, another class-based aspect of this that the media should be covering and is not. People have generally and rightfully said that you do have to take into account particularly elderly people who are living on a fixed income. But the reality that, again, many people don't actually understand this, is that Social Security is not a fixed income benefit. Social Security is inflation adjusted. And so people who are anxious about being able to pay their bills, inflation mean that Social Security benefits will be raised by 6% almost in January. So that is going to be a welcome help for people in that situation. But again, not something that people are saying, hey, listen, don't panic because your benefits are going up. People don't hear that because that is not being covered for the most part.
Well, just finally, looking forward in terms of what folks are going to be hearing, including about themselves, I just saw before we got on, I saw a Yahoo Money headline, Americans are feeling lousy about their finances, even though they're doing fine. I mean, I don't know, isn't that gaslighting? You know, just looking forward to the headlines we're going to be seeing about inflation, what are some questions you would have folks just keep in mind as they read and hear that media coverage?
Yeah, so I mean, just keep in mind the class bias of the media, as they say. It is particularly apparent now. They do not tell both sides of the inflation story by any means. And also keep this in mind a year from now when they are going to have completely forgotten about this issue because inflation almost certainly will dissipate it and will be, you know, more like 2 or 3%.
Absolutely. Well, we've been speaking with John Schwartz. You can find his work on TheIntercept.com. Thank you so much, John Schwartz, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
An article by our next guest begins with the news that a Connecticut judge has found radio host Alex Jones liable in the defamation claim brought against him by parents of 6- and 7-year-old children killed in the Sandy Hook massacre for falsely claiming they were accomplices in faking the murders of their own children, because that's the kind of sentence we get to hear in 2021. Alex Jones has urgently and repeatedly told millions of people that Hillary Clinton runs a child trafficking ring from the back of a pizza parlor, that Donald Trump won the 2020 election, and that tangy tangerine supplements made him lose 37 pounds in 2 months. The thing is, when Jones's ex-wife was suing him for custody of their children, because reportedly she didn't want them around someone who tells ardent followers he wants to break people's necks or have women sexually assaulted or lawyers' heads brought to him on a pike, Jones's defense was that he is just playing a character. Nobody is supposed to believe what he says. Asking Jones to account for things he says, his lawyers assert, is like judging Jack Nicholson by his depiction of the Joker in Batman. Well, Jones's most recent court loss is around those claims that the 2012 Connecticut shooting that killed 20 first graders and 6 educators was a government plot to take away American guns, and that grieving parents were paid actors in the scheme. It's that case and what it leaves unresolved that our guest is here to discuss. Enrique Armijo is a law professor at Elon University, as well as an affiliate fellow of the Yale Law School Information Society Project. He joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Enrique Armijo.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Well, this judgment from Connecticut, which is similar to previous ones around Jones's shtick around the Sandy Hook massacre, it was a default judgment. What does that mean and what doesn't that mean?
Well, what it basically means is that the reason that Alex Jones has, in effect, for purposes of this trial, has been found to be liable is not because his legal arguments were considered on their merits and rejected, but rather that he just refused to defend himself against these state law claims brought against him in Connecticut and Texas by the Sandy Hook parents for the claim is of defamation. So what that means is that the juries in these cases are now simply going to go on and decide damages, that is, the degree to which Alex Jones's statements harmed the reputations and caused emotional distress for these families. What it doesn't mean, as I said, is that there have been conclusive rulings at the state court level or really United States Supreme Court level with respect to the First Amendment regarding some of the First Amendment issues that would have been at issue in this case had it been litigated on the merits.
Yeah, it seems important that his actions are self-protective in a way, like by just not participating, he preserves his ability in the minds of some to say, I never had my day in court, you know, and at the same time to say, I refuse to participate in this corrupt system, which of course is going to be part of his rhetoric. But in your piece for The Conversation that explores this, you talk about how this sort of defamation claim might have been seen differently by courts even up to the 1950s. So what's changed?
Well, prior to the 1950s and prior really to the United States Supreme Court's kind of intervention into state law defamation claims, and state law defamation claims are basically allegations that a speaker has said something that's false and that negatively affects the reputation of the subject of that statement, and which has caused the subject of the statement damages that are compensable in state court. And it would have been basically prior to the constitutionalization by the United States Supreme Court of these state law claims, plaintiffs like the Sandy Hook parents would have simply had to show that the statement was about them and that it caused them some harm and that there was some minor, what's known in the law of defamation as degree of fault, where basically the statement was made by the speaker defendant without any kind of reasonable investigation or whether or not the statement was actually true. So what happened in a case that I talk about, a very famous case called New York Times versus Sullivan, is that the United States Supreme Court basically said, because of the First Amendment, people should be freer to speak about public officials, including the possibility that some of the statements that they make about public officials might be false. So we had to protect these kinds of statements, even false statements, by saying that the plaintiffs in these cases, so in other words, public officials who thought they were defamed by other people's statements, would have to show what's known as actual malice. So what that means is that the speaker has to have made the false statement either knowing that it was false or with reckless disregard as to whether or not it was true. So New York Times versus Sullivan was a case brought by a police commissioner in Alabama against the New York Times. In later cases, as I kind of go through in some detail in the piece, this idea that it should be harder for public officials to show defamation because the First Amendment wants to encourage people to talk about public officials without risk of being held liable, that was kind of extended to not just public officials, and the case basically means elected officials or individuals in very high levels of government, but also what the Supreme Court called public figures. So these are folks that are not elected officials or not service in government, but they're otherwise notable in a way that the First Amendment should permit discussion about them. And the Supreme Court essentially applied the degree of fault of public officials from the Sullivan case to public figures in a series of cases. And public figures essentially, in many instances, are otherwise private people. So the idea that it would be harder to show defamation extended to private people who were, for purposes of litigation, what's known as limited purpose public figures.
Which is an odd sort of thing. It's like you came into the news, so at now you are a limited purpose public figure. And that's Gertz v. Welch that you're talking about. How did that change things in that way?
Exactly. So in other words, if you were a person who had kind of inserted yourself into a controversy, in the Gertz case, the Supreme Court said that it should be harder for you to show that someone else has defamed you because, again, there's a First Amendment interest in this talking about the controversy. And one of those justifications in saying that it should be harder for public figures to show defamation is, as you just said, that the public figure has the opportunity to protect their own reputation. So in other words, if I'm a public figure and I'm defamed and I want to rebut that defamation, people will listen to me, right? There'll be an audience for my self-help. And also, the fact that I think this is the issue in the Jones case that I talk about, the fact that I voluntarily inserted myself into a controversy essentially means that I have assumed the risk of potential defamation when other people talk about that controversy, including my role in that controversy.
Well, we can see why this is very much a live and thorny issue. And there is the role of the internet, which, as you indicate in the piece, has changed defamation laws, as you're starting to talk about, has changed that idea that folks have a platform to speak back against the defamation. And yet, you know, we still have the law and harm is still done. So how does that bring us back to Alex Jones?
Well, the legal issues in the case as brought by the parents were initially being litigated, and one issue to litigate initially is basically Alex Jones and other folks involved with InfoWars, their state of mind with respect to these statements that they were making about the parents. And what Alex Jones was arguing is that the parents essentially had to show that Alex Jones made the statements knowing that they were false, because the parents had kind of injected themselves into this controversy about gun rights, and that in one case they were advocating about stricter gun laws in the United States in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting. And what I try to get at in the piece is that is a very dangerous argument for defendants in defamation cases to make, because, as you said, the internet has really changed the distinction between public and private. And one of the things that it's done with respect to defamation law is to make it much easier that someone is a public figure, right? So in other words, if you put something on the internet, if you make an argument on the internet, and then someone defames you, the person that defames you is going to basically say that you've inserted yourself in the controversy. Now I can say anything about you and not be sued for it unless you can show that I knew it was false. And obviously, state of mind is hard to prove, right? So, and as you said, you know, at the beginning, the kind of Alex Jones and these types of folks kind of modus operandi is to say, I'm just raising questions. Yeah. You know, I don't know what's true or false, you know, to use the quintessential Donald Trump term. People are saying this. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it, but people are saying it. So once you get into this very rigorous requirement that you have to basically show that someone knew the defamatory statement was false or acted with what's known as reckless disregard as to whether or not it was true, by making it easier to argue folks are public figures, you've also made it much more difficult for people who claim that they're still private people to successfully sue for defamation.
Well, and I just want to end on that note that it's being presented and can be presented as just media mouthiness, and we can't lose sight of the fact that there are people impacted here. And in the piece, you say that one of the impacts, one of the effects of making individuals prove actual malice against someone like Jones would encourage families, for example, to take the tragedies that happen to them and swallow them silently. So once again, when we talk about the First Amendment, when we talk about speech, we often talk about the speaker, and we have to also keep in mind chilling effect and the effect on other people when they are not allowed to hear things because people are scared to say them.
And that's really kind of the fear that I really express in the piece with respect to this issue, is that I don't think I certainly wouldn't want, and I don't think any fair-minded person would want, a parent who has suffered this kind of tragedy to basically be thinking about preserving their right to sue someone for defamation later if they decided that one of the things they wanted to do with that grief was to try to make sure the incident didn't happen again. I think what would happen if the Alex Jones side of this argument would win, so these parents, rather than speaking out and trying to prevent other school shootings, they would think, well, I want to remain private. I want to protect my own reputation. And there's a real First Amendment loss to that, because we don't get to hear from people who really have the most important things to say about these tragic events and how to potentially prevent them in the future.
We've been speaking with Enrique Armijo, professor of law at Elon University. His article, Alex Jones Loses Sandy Hook Case, But Important Defamation Issues Remain Unresolved, can be found at theconversation.com. Enrique Armijo, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Try the Toscana. Come on, don't give a darn. It's just the cutest dance because you don't advance, you just retreat.
You just retreat.
1930s in merry old England. Well, actually, I think it was right before World War II, so it had to be later than 39 or so. I don't know when they stopped Bob. We got John Grant on. He's got the New York Times. They probably got it in there. When did the Germans start bombing Britain? I don't know, but that was Harry Roy and his Bat Boy Orchestra. That's some classic old-time music, dance music. So, John, what is going on in the New York Times today?
Well, today, let's go to the front page. Hang on.
Yeah, what's the top headline?
Top right headline is suspect face many charges before the guy who ran over people in Wasauka, or what is it, in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce that name.
Wasauka. Waukesha, I guess. And the other story on top story is President seeks to retain Powell. He wants to the Jerome Powell as the Fed leader, but that's, we don't really want to do much of that. Putin tries to erase history of gulag atrocities. It's like we don't want to talk about our history in America, slavery and slaughtering Indians. Well, he doesn't want to talk about the gulags either. That's very unpleasant.
Yeah.
Good PR, So Putin's a little upset at that. They're going after Cuomo. They're really busting Cuomo's balls here. Let me tell you.
Is there enough evidence that he's really, was he playing stinky fingers
I think the hypocrisy factor is the biggest thing, because what they're doing now is investigation also found that Mr. Cuomo abused his power to help produce what would become a $5.1 million pandemic memoir, providing new details about how much of the government staff was used to help him write, publish, and promote his book. So he used his authority's powers to get this book done about how he was so wonderful with the pandemic, and now they've got him on hashtag MeToo stuff, and they're also, he apparently wasn't so wonderful on the pandemic stuff. So poor Mario Cuomo is on the run here. anger fills Europe's streets as lockdown spread.
Oh, yeah. I saw that.
One big holiday, 20 million airline passengers, everybody's flying and going to see grandma and all that stuff. I just went to the giant grocery store and got my annual free 23-pound turkey.
Oh, my God, that's a huge.
My wife
gets
one, too. We buy so many groceries there, we each get a 20-pound turkey, We'll have turkey coming
like
out
that
of our ears.
Here.
Oh,
yeah, we don't get anything like that out here.
This is a blue state special, man.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys got it made between the governors.
Anyway, the two trials, of course, one just ended with Kyle Rittenhouse, was 100% acquitted. We can talk about that because the judge weighed in. A lot of people are joking, including my wife, that the judge was like his grandfather, and acting like he was his grandfather. And so I watched last night the hour-long interview by Tucker Carlson on Fox of Kyle Rittenhouse. It's very, very interesting. Kyle Rittenhouse, like every human being on the planet, is a more complicated person than everybody in this polarized, ridiculous world we live in has made clear. I mean, he's not this crazy. Apparently, has no connections whatsoever to white supremacist groups. Now, he says that, others say that, and it may be true. And he's you know, he doesn't, he says he supports Black Lives Matter. He was not there against a Black Lives Matter demonstration. He was there against looting and burning and that sort of thing. I see him a little like, I forget the guy's name, the guy in the Atlanta bomber, you know, Clint Eastwood make a movie out of it, you know, the guy that was in
that?
The Olympic bombing in Atlanta.
Oh, 15 years ago.
That guy was innocent.
Yeah.
Well, he lived with his mama. Kyle's 17, 18. He lives with his mother. And he is a cop wannabe. I mean, he definitely wants to be a cop kind of figure. You know, he wants to be a nurse, too, which is really interesting. You know, and an armed nurse, you know, and so, you know, it was just a very interesting interview. I don't think he should have been acquitted of everything. I think it's unfortunate that the judge threw out, I think it was two, you know, wrist-slapping charges, minor charges, that, you know, he didn't allow the jury to rule on. So it was either murder or nothing, and they chose nothing.
They could have really had voluntary manslaughter in other parts of the country. I don't know.
But how about intentional provocative behavior?
My job. It was Richard Jewell.
Richard Jewell, that you were talking about. My editor.
Security
good work.
Guard. Yeah. Richard Jewell, Centennial Olympic Park bombing listeners. July 1996 in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was during the Summer Olympics. You may remember that. It was quite a ways back.
And, of course, Clint Eastwood, a very well-known, notorious right-winger, did a movie about a year ago on Richard Jewell, in which it seemed to me the subtext was the only purpose to do this movie was to show at the time of, the deep state criticisms from the right, was to show the abuses of the FBI against this Richard Jewell, which is true. I mean, he was innocent, and they railroaded him, tried to railroad him. And so in this case, it's just much, much more complicated than either the left or the right put it. You know, it's crazy. This is the world we live in, but it's crazy that this young, not even adult, has no right to carry this loaded weapon. Yet somehow that's overlooked, you know. The key legal thing here is that this human being who's underage was illegal, you know, should not have been carrying a loaded weapon. There's reasons why teenagers are not allowed to carry loaded weapons. Because, you know, like he indicated in the trial, he broke down into tears all the time. Very touching. He looks like a cherub. You know, you want to sympathize with him. And it's just a railroad job, it seems to me. And out of it is you get this innocent cherub, who literally was defending himself. I mean, if a guy goes into the Aurora movie theater or a Sandy Run or whatever the schools that somebody shot up, you know, and you shoot 13 kids, and somebody comes and threatens you with a gun, and you shoot him, you can't say I shot him for self-defense. I mean, it was self-defense, but you know, it doesn't work legally unless, of course, you are, you know, blind justice in the wrong direction. You know, you're not paying attention. I mean, it's, you know. Anyway, that's the Kyle Rittenhouse.
It's
rife with all kinds of problems because it's going to encourage and provoke and lead to, you know, garden variety psychopaths with guns going into demonstrations. They won't be 17-year-old cherubs, you know. But we'll wait and see, you know.
Well, they eliminated so much evidence that could be used. I mean, the guy was 17. He didn't even have a driver's license.
Right.
His mother drove him over the state line to get his gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was a week, 10 days before, there's this videotape that was not allowed to be admitted. That's where the judge yelled at prosecutor Bringer for, that's what the big yelling, that's what it was about.
I know.
Bringer was bringing up
victims.
That was early. That was like day two or something. As it got closer and closer to the closing arguments and, you know, that I was watching this and I thought, what are they talking about? Well, they're talking about Bringer was trying to bring in, was trying to bring in the fact that Kyle was sitting in a car watching with another, there's a video of him watching through the front windshield of a car with another guy who was filming it with his phone. These black clad, they may have been black or white. They were coming out of a store. This is long before demonstrations. And did you see that video? I mean, he said,
I have no idea what you're leading up to now.
He's sitting in the car and he's watching these kids or whatever shoplift. Mm-hmm. They're shoplifting. That's what they think. The occupants
of
the car. And the guy. And Kyle says, I wish I had my AR. I would take some shots at. I would shoot these people. Kyle said that in the seat of the video.
And he would.
The video
would not. It was not allowed in as evidence.
They wouldn't. It was not allowed in as evidence, even towards establishing his disposition mentally. Ten days before he went in there. Plus, there's video of him beating up a girl who was literally beating the shit out of this girl who was in a fight with his sister. With his sister. He didn't have lost his driver's license. Let's go over this. He had a friend I can't establish it, but I'm pretty well. He got his pandemic check. Okay?
Right.
And he gave the money to Dominic Black in Wisconsin across the state line.
Mm-hmm.
Had Dominic Black, his buddy, buying him a gun and kick in on buying Dominic a gun, okay, AR-15. And Dominic, the agreement was Dominic would keep it in the basement of his dad's house in a vault, in a gun vault.
Uh-huh.
And it came out, Dominic Black later testified on the witness stand during this trial. He said, Prosecutor Bringer, well, who gave him that gun the night of the shooting? And he said, I didn't do it, and he wiggled around. Now, Dominic Black is facing serious prison time for buying this gun for Kyle Rittenhouse. This kid is over 18, and he's facing serious prison time for buying. And this trial is going to go on, and he is, plea bargaining for cooperating.
Yeah.
And cooperating in the prosecution of Kyle Rittenhouse. And what did he say? He got on the stand and he said, well, I don't know how he got it. He went, you know, he went down the base. He ended up getting the gun. You know, I don't know how he got it, but we don't, he may be lying. I don't know. But we know this. Kyle went to his dad, to Dominic Black's basement, and his dad, Dominic Black's father's gun vault, or safe, and got the gun out somehow. And Prosecutor Bringer said, well, what would happen if you didn't give him the gun or your dad, your father, refused to give him the gun? And he said, Kyle would, this is a quote, he would have thrown a fit if we didn't give him his gun.
Right.
So, and then we know, and it's a fact, that the Kenosha Police Department was in an agreement with the militia or vigilantes, whatever you want to call the car lot lizards that were armed with guns at the car lot, that they were going to push the crowds down South Sheridan Street towards them, towards the armed vigilantes guarding the car spot. And Kyle, and there's video Kyle And this Iraq war vet, I don't know, I can't remember, BLAC, I think is his last name.
Uh-huh.
He escorted with a gun, as was his armed escort, as Kyle walked up towards the crowd and started offering medical aid, ha, 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 as an EMT, which was a lie also.
Right. Again, he aspired to be a nurse, he told Tucker Carlson. I see no reason why not to believe him. So, he did have a medical pack, but whether he knew how to use that as much as he knew how to use the weapon, I don't know if he ever fired the AR-15.
They did go out,
So he knew what he was
doing.
He seems to know what he was doing when he is on the ground. He doesn't let go of the thing, and he swings it around, and he hits the guy he shot him in the arm. But I guess what is so amazing about this is that, this is the American justice system. Can appeal out the wazoo. If you're convicted, you can appeal out the wazoo. That's why, you have all these appeals, lawyer Dershowitz, et cetera, these slum gumbags. A lot of them are good people. I don't want to knock them, but... if you're guilty, you can appeal up to the Supreme Court. But if you're acquitted, double jeopardy, it's a done deal. And, of course, that judge knows that. So that judge can err on the side of being a bad judge and preferences and all that because he rules that courtroom. And he can, prejudice preferences for, in this case, Kyle Rittenhouse, that all of us would question, legal experts would question, but if the jury comes along and acquits him, there's nothing they can do. The man has gotten away with being a shitty judge. That's simply the way it looks. I mean, something should have been set upon this kid, some 6 months in jail or something. He already did, over 90 days, I think, in jail.
Who?
And here's Kyle Rittenhouse.
No.
He was in jail for 87 days.
Okay, all right.
He was in jail, and this is a real story. Listen to me.
Right.
He had two lawyers, Pierce and somebody else, who grabbed on him immediately, and they were going to raise funds for him. Well, they did. They raised, by September, early September, they raised $1 million. And he, Kyle's figuring, they're going to bail me out with this money. That's what it's for. Pierce, his lawyer, told him, no, we want you to stay in prison. It's good for raising funds. So they kept the son of a bitch in prison for 2 months so they could use his case, they've jailed him and all this, the martyr, effect, and raise much, much, much more money to turn him into a political cause celeb on the right. And he's pissed off at his jail. He was nailing these two lawyers as scumbags because they kept him in jail, and it was very unpleasant for him in jail. So there's that angle that he says he now has very competent lawyers. And Matt Gaetz wants him to be his aide. And, he's going to have, job offers all over the place, to me, he reminds me of a baby-faced Russell Crowe. He looks like a little like Russell Crowe, broad face. if you ever wanted an actor to play an early character of Russell Crowe, you'd have him. It would fit.
I never thought of that, but yeah, he does sort of look.
I don't
like
know.
Him,
I just had this flash on Russell Crowe when I was watching him interviewed.
You should put him in gladiator armor and
right.
Have him.
Gladiator Junior.
And have him go down and mow down Antifa and all them communists running the country.
Right.
The whole country
being
ran by communists.
He has an incredible future because, as you know, one of the right-wing jerks on Fox, Judge Peer, whatever her name is, she's a...
Oh, yeah, the big mouth.
Vicious piece
she's
of work.
Big mouth.
Yeah, she's... I don't know if she's a real judge or what, but anyway, she was going on and on about, you know, what a mature and smart individual he was, and of course he is. And he seems, when he's interviewed, he seems... much more mature than 17 or 18. He seems,
mature. Oh, come on. You know, now I understand that Tucker Carlson embedded a film crew, a video crew,
right
throughout his.
Oh, yeah.
Throughout
absolutely.
Before the trial. Even.
Well, I'm not. Look, I'm a journalist. I understand. I mean, Tucker Carlson has an agenda. Tucker Carlson, just like his lawyer Pierce, has an agenda and is exploiting this kid. There is absolutely no question about that. But, the interview revealed a lot of very interesting things. But he is being exploited. He says he now has very competent lawyers, and I'm sure he does because he's going to become – incredible cause celeb for vigilantism. I mean, it's just unbelievable with the potential of this case, this Cherokee kid.
Oh, I agree.
Who was a hero. And this kid, isn't one of his more attractive suits, but he's delighted with this idea of himself as a hero. You know, he loves this idea. Clint Eastwood's probably too old to make his movie now, but, Clint Eastwood is 91, I think, or he just made a movie called Cry Macho, which is about a kid who's a son of a friend of his. He goes to Mexico who has a fighting cock, rooster. His name is Macho. It's in Mexico, and geriatric Clint Eastwood drives down to get this kid and bring him back up to the States for the father, who he owes the father, right? And it's all these adventures. It's from a novel. And here is 91-year-old Clint Eastwood walking around with a stoop in a movie called Cry Macho about a fighting cock rooster, you know? This is American culture.
Well, that's what I named my first newsletter, The Fighting Cock Flyer, and I think it's
there you go.
Maybe Clint and I are
there.
Point
you go. A couple of macho guys. Yeah.
But I mean, Kyle Rittenhouse. I mean, I think. Clint Eastwood's going to die before he gets a chance to get banged.
Oh, I do too.
And
Kyle, poor Clint,
When Kyle was crying, he broke down and was crying when they found out that he was going to be walking out free.
Right.
And he did run out free through the judge's chambers, ironically enough, to his security detail, a bodyguard that he had.
Right, of course.
To whisk him out of the courthouse out the back way. When he broke down, one of the persons watching this with me, she said, "That's pathetic." And I said, "Well, I don't think he's breaking down because he's sad. He's breaking down because he just won the lottery."
Exactly.
And,
he's breaking down because well, that's all the accumulated tension. I mean, he asked to answer the question, what was he feeling? He thought he could get life in prison without parole. It's very possible. I mean, that was the horror that was stewing in him for days and days and weeks, And when he is exonerated 100%, I mean, he turned into a bowl of jelly. And, I think I would too. It's like, Christ almighty. I thought I was going to spend my life in jail, and now I'm a free man. And, God, half the nation thinks I'm a hero. Holy shit. And, this is America, But that, you know, he's going to be an example that's going to be, talk about exploitation, exploited, abused, twisted.
Right.
And how the courts in the future, of course, very right-wing courts, very successful, the ascendancy of the right from the mid-70s, one of the things they always had their eye on was the Supreme Court. And, you know, they've loaded it. Donald Trump, 3 Supreme Court picks. How can that be? It was a fluke, but they also, the corruption of McConnell in the Senate prevented one of those. And, you know, it's gotten to the point that Michelle Goldberg, I don't know if you know who she is, she's a, you know, a regular columnist at the New York Times.
Yeah.
And she's writing about, the headline is, The Problem of Political Despair. And this is, you know, this is a column in which Bannon and all these far-right people will just be ecstatic and delighted and giggling and laughing wholeheartedly at this. You know, it's like you won the lottery when you get Michelle Goldberg saying, political despair is an issue for the entire Democratic Party. I suspect that part of it is about growing hopelessness, born of a sense that dislodging Trump has brought American democracy only a brief reprieve. And she says her friend Chris Hayes, the MSNBC host, uses the phrase, the bad feeling. Quote, the bad feeling is that pit of the stomach feeling that we're not okay, and it's not clear we're going to be okay. And then it goes on. What's terrifying is that even if Democrats win back public confidence, they can win more votes than Republicans and still lose. Gerrymandering alone is enough to up the balance in the House. North Carolina state Joe Biden lost by 1.3 percentage points, just passed a redistricting. Man, it goes on and on and on. Democrats won the popular vote in 7 out of the 8 presidential elections. I mean, absorb that for a minute. You know what I mean? The idea that density in urban centers diminishes your voting power. You become like blacks were 3/5 of a human being in the sense of the electoral politics in America.
Well,
if you live in a city, you know?
And there's a flip side to it. In the red states, mm-hmm. like in Texas,
right.
You have these repressive laws being passed mm-hmm. about women, and they're literally using a legal technique of the fugitive slave idea where women leave Texas to get abortion, that the women that they could collect, there could be bounty hunters looking online and filing these claims to get $10,000.
That whole version of abortion law in Texas and how it empowers vigilantism is incredible.
Precedent
and the Kyle Rittenhouse symbolic model. If we don't have more violence in the very near future, I will be surprised.
The Christmas parade is evident. Now, this guy has the alleged criminal or alleged suspect or whatever, driver.
He's a piece of work. He's a piece of work.
But he hasn't said he did it because of Kyle yet.
But this is a guy, Sean Hannity, believe it or not, you know, on MSNBC, it was like the 5th story, right? Well, you get to Sean Hannity, it's the number one story, and mealy-mouthed, mile-a-minute Sean Hannity's gone off. It's like a spittle coming out of his mouth. He's so excited, you know, that here, and they got a picture of a black man with dreadlocks who looks like the worst stereotypical black criminal you could ever possibly imagine, And he said, then he goes a black screen and he gives the guy's rap sheet.
Yeah.
1996 to, you know, 2011, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, he does say that he's a wannabe rap artist with a rap sheet along your arm, you know, and uses rap twice there, you know, rap, black music, and, you know, gets all that black stuff in there, you know.
Right.
Right. And anyway, he's showing this guy's picture and, you know, and how he ran down all these grandmothers and children. And it's like, well, I mean, this is horrible. Take the man out back and shoot him. You know, I mean, this is a worthless human being. I don't care if he's white or black. You know, he just ran over somebody within the week with his same car, you know. Anyway, and the guy was let out on bail. So this is a bail thing, you know, and it's... you know, it's you know, here we go.
Well, you know, I have an announcement to make, a real short one. I've got a I've taken up this booklet. You know, I've this essay. It's an editorial written by a guy out in Pennsylvania.
You're breaking up.
I don't know. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I got
I might
you.
Be breaking up. It's an editorial by Professor Adolph Reed Jr. He's in the political science department there in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh, University of Pennsylvania. Yeah, I've heard that name. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he's all over. He gets on YouTube as a guest on several shows. That's how I discovered him.
And I'm sorry, what's his name again?
Adolph Reed Jr. Adolph Reed. He goes
by
Adolph.
Okay, now what is
Reed.
What is the piece you're talking about? What is it about?
It's a good essay, and I'm reprinting it, and it's going to go out to all of our our Radio Free Kansas subscribers and listeners, including you. And it's called The Whole Country is the Reichstag.
Oh,
and no, that's the name of it. The whole country
is right.
And it really is a in-depth look at, and this was written several months before Kyle, what we're seeing right now. And he has it's just one section after another. It's not a very long editorial. Well, it is, but I include the footnotes. And you'll get a hard copy of it. And we're probably going to try to have him on Radio Free Kansas and may have him on with you.
Absolutely. I could try to hook him up.
And,
really?
Yeah. I figured you and I could probably really work him over the coals and get some truth out of him. He's a real smart guy, real, real smart guy. I mean, since I've laying it out and printing it and sending it out to people, I've read it several times.
Right.
And there's a sentence in here that apply, but he points out this is what he says, and I want to read it to you, John, because before you get, you're going to get your copy, of course, but he says, continuing, and I'll be real, it's a short part, he calls it, continuing to proclaim the country is on the verge of explosion could help mobilize a Republican vote in 2022. And the newly imposed voter suppression technique all too easily could give the GOP control of both houses of Congress.
Yeah, right.
And from there, it would be an easy step to impeaching Biden. So he's saying that by continuing to proclaim the country's on the verge of explosion, this could help to mobilize the Republicans. I think we're seeing that right now.
It's a vicious cycle. That's why I'm saying, you know, Michelle Goldberg.
Right.
I'm not sure it's wise for Democratic liberal columnists to be kvetching like that, because it's so rewarding for the right to read that. You know, I mean,
that's
you have
right.
to think about it. And also the other, there's all this, there's, you know, all the all sorts of problems here, you know, with all this stuff. Well, what am I trying to think here? Yeah, well, of course, the gerrymandering is one thing, and what you're talking about, this idea of the horror, and you know, America's coming unglued, so therefore people want police,
yeah,
things, for right-wing things to control things. And, of course, and she suggests this, that a lot of the moralization on the left is going to, she worries, lead to not voting. And also, in my concern, it's going to lead people to find, you know, some Green Party flaco to gravitate their votes to that makes them feel good, you know.
Yeah.
But basically cuts them off at the knees as human beings, you know, in a democracy. So that there's all these factors, and to what degree they will have impact, who knows. There's all these factors that mitigate against Democrats winning. And the more and more and more we learn about this, to the Republicans' delight, these sadistic bastards up there, they, you know, they're more delighted because it's working. It is working. Now, my feeling is the only hope is that somehow reason is going to break in the morning dawn, you know, be by election day 2022-2024, and the Democrats are going to realize that if we want democracy with a small d at all, we better have the hellacious turnout. You got to get every goddamn buddy on the left to get your ass to the polls, mail it, or whatever you have to do. You know, do it. Just fucking do it. But, you know, Michelle Goldberg is worrying that it's going to do the opposite. It's going to drop the turnout. And but who knows, you know? Who knows what happens in a year from next month or 3 years from next month? I mean, in America, you know, things can change on a dime. This is a really fickle culture. You know, the wind will shift and blow everybody the other way. You just don't, you can't predict the future too well. Who knows? Again, it's a big question, and everybody, you know, a lot of people like Michelle Goldberg are kvetching and worrying and, oh, my God, uh-huh, this guy is falling. You know, here we go.
Well, this is ironically,
you know, it's interesting times, you know. What are you going to do?
Oh, yeah. Well, Professor Reed, he comes to a similar conclusion. Well, I wouldn't call it a conclusion. What you just said about a record turnout necessitating stopping this fascist juggernaut.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what I would call it.
Right.
It's rolling through, and it just keeps rolling because, you know, elections are the only thing that can dampen anything. And I don't know. Reed says part of his editorial is that. I mean, he says that unless this happens. And he says that in 2022, if you don't, you could lose a whole generation politically.
In fact, I think Goldberg suggests this, that, you know, if they won 2022, like you even bring up impeachment, you know, I mean, they would, like the Democrats, have the numbers to convict is an open question. But, you know, God knows what they're capable of doing. And then, you know, and then, of course, once they gain power, if they gain power back in 2024, the suggestion is, even if they lose power, they're not going to relinquish it. They're not going to say they lost. But if they won, they're going to set up their ducks in the future so that they can never lose, like Viktor Orban in Hungary or something like that. We have models out there. You know, Tucker Carlson has even gone over there and done stories on, you know, the corrupt, quote, democracy of Hungary and Viktor Orban as the model for the right here in America. Anyway, you know, as I say, it's, you know, it's a blessing and a curse to live in interesting times, as they say. You know, and we certainly qualify for that. I think. You know.
I don't know. I'm not interested in this.
You don't find that interesting?
No, I don't find I find this
scary.
Dangerous.
Well, I would say it is potentially very dangerous. You're right. As I say, I expect violent incidents to start breaking out. I don't know why they haven't, given how crazy this is, except there was a obvious, you look back at the thing, an obvious restraint January 6th that nobody brandished a loaded weapon. Because if a loaded weapon, except for that one guy who shot, what's her name, inside as she was breaking into the House chambers, if you know, a weapon had been pulled out there on the tarmac and all that, it would have, you know, it would have been a massacre of sorts, probably. Because there's one guy that has just been nailed. I think he's just arrested. But they have connected him to January 6th, and he was carrying some bizarre pistol, a huge Ruger pistol, I think it was Ruger. I've seen him advertised that you can put shotgun shells in it or huge bullets. And so he had, I guess it's a revolver with huge holes in it, right? And he had loaded it, say there's six shots. Three of them were with shotgun shells, and three of them were hollow point bullets. And he was going after, made a big public scene that he made a telephone or an email, I guess it was, or something that they have evidence of, that said he is just, or they're just lucky, he's lucky that the police confiscated his weapon because he was in an alteration and the cops took it. The cops took it, that gun.
Where
on
was
the apron
that?
Of the Congress on January 6th.
Oh,
and all that melee. He wasn't arrested. They just confiscated his gun. And he has said that read between the lines of what he says, he was going to use that. He would have used that against Nancy Pelosi if he'd found her. And, you know, he said, I'm lucky, or else you'd have had me for something else, he says. Now, there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts about all that, but, it's pretty serious. I mean, with a bizarro weapon like that, with, in his mind, a target on Nancy Pelosi as he's breaking into the Congress. So I imagine this guy, they're going to put him away for quite a while.
Well, they had armed catches. They had ammunition dumps. They had places in hotel rooms where they were stockpiling their guns.
Exactly.
Storing their guns.
Like hundreds of ammo, lots of them. Yeah.
They had a special, some sort of team they referred to. I can't think of it right now, the name they used. But it was teams of people who were going to move those weapons out.
Mm-hmm.
To the Capitol, if required, if walkie-talkie, you know, that's all
right,
these
right,
days.
Right,
you know, they were
right.
They were in communication and ready to move the arms to the Capitol, you know,
right.
on a moment's notice. I mean, there was real lethality.
Yeah,
behind the people that were that were bashing their way into the Capitol. Behind
that. Well, there's
the
guy with all those handcuff ties. You know, he had dozens of them. Now,
right.
What the hell was he planning to do with them? You know, or is that just part of, like, Kyle Rittenhouse said, I wasn't planning to shoot anybody. I just was carrying an AR-15 because I thought it looked cool. You know, he's a 17-year-old. It looks cool, you know. Well, is he walking around with all these twist tie handcuffs on his, you know, maybe 30 of them on his belt, just to look cool, or what does he plan to do with those goddamn things? You know, I don't know.
Well, what I'm saying, I'm trying to emphasize, is that the how can you assess these events and not think that there is lethality in the air against domestic political
Absolutely.
Adversaries? And I say what's bothering me is that the liberal or the left, I don't know what you want to call us, you know, I mean, it's beginning to be more and more like, I sort of get the opinion that Reed has got it right, except we're in Reichstag moments. Each of these things could turn into the Reichstag, because the Reichstag was used by the fascists and the conservatives shut down civil liberties and newspapers and put Michelle Goldberg in jail and you know,
incinerator. What do you mean put her in jail?
Well, I mean, immediately, I mean, I got to, after I was laying out and publishing this essay, I went back and I made a photographic montage in the first few, I took some liberties with the booklet. Added photographs and stuff too, because Professor Reed expressed in one of his YouTube talks that he was worried that there are so many people that people have forgotten the lesson of the Reichstag. He says there's a lot of people who don't even know what it is.
Well, also there is this idea, this assumption, idea that was an anomaly, you know, that the Nazis in Germany were an anomaly, you know, the mechanized death, et cetera. And, you know, that was unique. There's no question about it. But there are analogous movements and dynamics in history that are interesting to observe, and all of that is very apropos to what's going on right now. The rise of Mussolini, you know, all the fascist Spain, you know, the southern cone of South America, you know, fascism comes in many shapes, forms, and flavors. But they seem to get their footholds and move into a culture in ways that are instructive to observe, you know, in an analogous sort of way. And that is important. The Reichstag fire was, you know, the same as the sinking of the Maine, you know, probably an inside job, you know, in order to provide a cause de belle, or what do they call it, a cause for war. Which is essentially what internally, domestically, the rise of fascism is. It's turning, you know, your own warlike attitudes and behaviors and whatnot internally onto your own people. Because, you know, we're now using some of the same techniques of mind-fucking people that we used around the world, starting with the Guatemala 1954, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this idea of bamboozling a culture with fake news and, you know, lies and bullshit and all this stuff.
Well, the critical part of it, of that, of the Reichstag, was that they were successful in demonizing, to a large portion of the German population, you would think Jews, well, they're there. That's just part of the racist vocabulary of the German, of the Aryan Germans at that time. But no, they demonized a 21-year-old, legally blind Dutch communist kid. He's a kid who's in a communist group.
Of course.
And they demonized him, and then they used that to arrest the next day 1,400 members of the German Communist Party at that time, and executed and sent them off to concentration camps, labor camps.
That's the perfect
and
example.
And they shut
go ahead.
And they shut, and they shut, and they started shutting down papers all within 5 days. They started shutting down papers, rounded up 1,400. I mean, and I see the same shenanigans going on when every available opportunity, Steve Bannon, or just name him, Gatz, Marjorie Greene, or whatever her name
is,
the crazy woman.
They're all running.
They shout it like a chorus.
Yep.
The Democratic Party is communist. They're socialist. You know, they're demonizing the Democratic Party using anti-communist.
Well, that works. I mean, it works. And, you know, calling somebody a communist works. And in fact, you know, the Nazis, when you know, when the fascism in the 30s, you know, they were going nose to nose with the communists because, you know, the Weimar Republic was a failure, like Mitch McConnell's Senate and whatnot. It was just, you know, a jerk-off legislature, I'm sorry. And, you know, and so they were ineffective, and so they, quote, had to make the trains run, and somebody had to make the trains run on time. So you had the fascists, and then you had the extreme of the communists. And a lot of those, you know, you see, as I've talked about, written about, is there are linkages between these extremes, right and left. And so once, you know, once the Weimar Republic is out of the picture, yes, well, the Nazis have to bust the chops of the communists, because while they may have been even allied with them at some point, once they do gain power over the equivalent of the deep state in the 30s, the Weimar Republic, they have to eliminate the communists because,
well,
you know, they're inconvenient for them at that point. And so with our culture right now, the analogy is all this crossover between, you know, Glenn Greenwald and the left and, you know, frustrated left and, you know, finding common ground with some of the people on the right. Tucker Carlson, as Glenn Greenwald on once a week these days. You know, once the right gets power, well, they're going to purge those lefties like you wouldn't fucking believe. You know, they
well,
are not going to be listening to them at that point. You know, although they may have helped them with spoiler parties and spoiler candidates and not voting and demoralization and all that stuff. You know?
And Greenwald's in Brazil, so I doubt there. But here's another historical.
Well, there you go. He's in Brazil, but he's, you know.
Here's a historical factoid. This thing, this Reichstag fire happened in 1933.
That's when FDR was inaugurated, right?
A long time before World War, the invasion of Poland. I mean, that's a long time before the invasion of Poland or Czechoslovakia, before there was actual real military invasion.
Well, they were establishing power, and it took them until, you know, the late 30s to assemble power significant enough in Germany that they could extend themselves to an imperial power and, you know, militarist power and start accumulating countries, you know, as their own equivalent colonies, I guess, you know.
Well, you can read it. This Adolf Reed, the whole country is a Reichstag. You can read it now. It's at the nonsite.org. But I'm printing it in hard copy and also making it available for
now,
free
is it
after
R- R E E D or R E I D?
R. It's Adolf Reed. R E E D.
Okay.
And it's the whole country is the Reichstag. Now, a lot of Americans probably don't even know how to spell Reichstag. Reichstag is R-E-I-C-H-S-T-A-G. And all you lucky listeners who subscribe to the Radio Free, or who listen to Radio Free Kansas and subscribe to my periodicals, will be getting a copy in less than a week in your mailbox.
All right.
And I think it's going to be a classic. I mean, as a book. As far as I can tell, it hasn't been printed on real paper ever. It's just it's an internet thing that's floating around, and I think there's a lot to this. And I think you'll keep it on your bookshelf and say, "Well, we were warned."
Ab- Absolutely. Like Paul Revere moment, man. You're like Paul Revere.
I know.
You know?
It's
the British are coming. The British are coming.
Except in this case, the Trumpians are coming. The Trumpians are coming. God. It's,
the Trumpians are coming, and they are us. Oh, my God.
They
yeah.
are. Yeah.
That's from remember Pogo, the possum in the swamp. He said, I've met the enemy, and the enemy is us.
Is us. Yeah, and we all look like Kyle Rittenhouse now.
Little
crazy stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, oh, man. I mean, I don't know what to think. I don't know what next can happen except.
Well, I think somebody should make a nice painting of Kyle Rittenhouse as a cherub with an AR-15 floating around in the sky, you know.
Yeah, put little angel wings on him like a
little
Cupid.
Little angel wings with his AR-15.
Well, you know, you never know. We got some artists who are quite good.
Well, my
artists,
dear wife is an artist. She's painting, she's painted one. She's painting the second of the four cops that testified to Capitol Police. She's got portraits of them all.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, she's now
that's
doing
really cool.
Facone, the big dude. And actually, she's competing with Joan Baez. Joan Baez has made a painting of the same guy.
Oh,
I think Luann's is better than Joan Baez, but that's my prejudice, I think. Yeah.
I didn't even know Joan Baez painted. Okay,
I didn't either until Luann told me that this morning. So, anyway, the guy's a leader here. And I love his, you know, he said, you know, he thought they were going to kill him. He really thought they were going to kill him when they grabbed him finally. And he finally, somebody got in and let him go. And he said publicly later, I love it. He said, thank you for saving my life, but fuck you for being there. Very articulate, eloquent, I thought, you know.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Thank you for saving my life, but fuck you for being there. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, it is truly dangerous, but there's a lot of stuff going on, and I don't think we can keep up with it. Good for you. Good for us. We've got John Grant and the New York Times.
The New York Times, yeah.
And this can't be happening. This can't be happening.
What a team. What a team with Radio Free Kansas, man. It's like a Murdoch Network or something there. You know?
Yeah, we'll do a big hat tip to Professor Diane out at the Big Apple in Kansas. Big hat tip to Professor Diane and to Professor Fred and all the academics that contribute and help me out.
Well, let's get some of these people on the radio. We can talk to them.
Yeah, let's get them on. All right.
All right.
Yeah, good idea.
All right. Take care, Mike.